we present the news quiz with your chairman, Simon Hoggart.
Hello and welcome again to the news quiz. We start with the cutting scene in the corrections and clarifications column of The Guardian on Thursday the 20th of May, read by Vaughan Savage.
Yesterday was Wednesday, despite an assertion that it was once again Tuesday.
Thanks to Keith Sullivan for that. Let's meet the teams. Please welcome first on my right, Linda Smith and Francis Ween. Opposite them on my left, Alan Corran and Andy Hamilton. Linda, who's caught between Iraq and a hard place?
Oh, Tony Blair suddenly started behaving like a girl in a horror film who suddenly realises that the boy that she's in the lonely house with is probably the murderer. Just getting a little bit edgy and saying, no, I wasn't trying to leave, I want to stay here with you. Oh, the phone's cut off, good. Then we're alone. He's getting a little bit windy about W. W, whose grasp on the English language has never been that firm, seems to be slipping altogether. He couldn't quite manage the name of the jail in Iraq the other day. So going and the terrible events at the Abu Ghraib, at the prison of Yabba Dabba Doo. There's all this sort of controversy about the 30th of June, when there's the handover to the Iraqi caretaker government, as they call it. Bush is trying to backpedal, he's trying to sort of win back the UN.
I think backpedal's a bit unsettling, given he's just fallen off his bike. I saw that and I thought, oh, they've taken his stabilisers off. And then I thought, no, how stable was he ever?
His spokesman explained it. He said, well, the road was quite wet and he was going quite fast. But you know this president, he does everything full on. And then he said, rather bizarrely, he said, he certainly wasn't whistling show tunes. Which I interpreted as some deep insecurity that the president might be gay. I don't know if you saw it. It was one masterful piece of politician technique from Tony Blair. One of the journalists at the press conference said to him, would the interim government be allowed to overrule the military in the case of an operation like the one against Fallujah? And he said, yes, very positively. And then he said, that is the key question.
This week, Tony Blair's call for the Iraqi government to have a veto over coalition military operations was rebuffed by Washington. After the handover of power in Iraq, UK and US troops will keep their own commanders. The UK will keep Jeff Hoon, and the US will keep their equivalent of Jeff Hoon, Mickey Mouse. 2 points to Linda. Francis, who believes our children stand a fat chance of living long and healthy lives?
Yes, now there's been a report by the Health Select Committee, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing apocalyptic stuff. Saying that every child in this country will now die before its parents because their children are now so enormously obese. I mean, they can't even walk the 100 yards to the nearest Burger King to get their 11s of a double whopper with fries and that sort of thing. And they make John Prescott look like Kate Moss. There's a huge national crisis. It's worse than smoking, apparently. It's killing everyone in the country.
Did you hear Norman Tebbit talking about this on the Today programme?
I'm sorry?
He kept talking about something altogether different. He was asked sort of what he thought about it. He said, well, it doesn't surprise me at all with the breakdown of the family and this bill on gay marriage going through Parliament. We have this incredible AIDS problem and we're basically legalising buggery. And I tell you what, John Humphreys woke up, definitely, at that point. Extraordinary. Is this some link between obesity and homosexuality that most of us are unaware of? His line seemed to be, it is immoral, it should be illegal, and it makes you fat. I just didn't follow it at all. Poor old Boris Johnson was just going, well, I don't, oh, goodness, oh, Lord, after all.
Well, Boris, Boris was playing the unaccustomed part of the voice of reason, I think.
Perhaps Norman thinks that obesity is just a posh word for buggery. Perhaps that's, maybe that's what he's...
There are a lot more chubby kids. When I was at primary school, in every single class there would be one asthmatic kid, one chubby kid, smattering of glasses. And one kid that smelt of wee. It was like they were government issue.
The Commons Health Select Committee has issued a report attacking the government, the food industry and advertisers for failing to tackle the country's huge rise in obesity. The committee wants a traffic-like system to mark out foods: green for healthy food, amber for food with some cause for concern, and red for all food served in Scotland. Andy, which political heavyweight accidentally started a game of Follow My Leader this week?
This is John Prescott.
It is.
Who has, on a few occasions now, speculated in a rather philosophical way about whether Tony Blair might like to widen his horizons. And they put him on the spot and said, do you think he will be Prime Minister at the next election? And he said, well, you know, probably, but who knows? There's always events, he said, like a rather sort of naff echo in a Radio 2 play or something. events. And he's being interpreted in some quarters as being less than supportive. Did anyone see, I don't know, if you saw the footage the other week, fantastic, but it tells you an awful lot about John Prescott, of him playing football with the children. Did you see that? He was opening some children's sports event, and a little boy got the ball and ran away, and John Prescott chased him and tripped him up. Gave him a good kind of whack on the shins, and the boy fell in a heap. And John Prescott turned back towards the cameras and walked towards the reporters, chortling away.
John Prescott fueled further speculation about Tony Blair's leadership this week when he cryptically suggested that future events might persuade him to quit as Prime Minister before the election. In response, Downing Street said Tony was getting on with the job. Bush's underpants don't iron themselves, you know. Alan, listen to this.
I gave a letter to the postman. He put it in his sack. Bright and early next morning, he brought my letter back. She wrote upon it, return to sender, address unknown, no such number, no such song.
Alan, why is address unknown bad for democracy? I think Andy knows the answer to this, don't you, Andy?
Oh, but then it's misdirected post, if you ask me. That's like putting it in next door. You have to go round, you have to ring the doorbell.
Is this about postal voting?
Yes.
And this ghastly thing coming up for the European elections. And I noticed that Joan Collins had joined Robert Kilroy Silk, and they now made up the United Kingdom Independence Party. And
Max,
believe me, no two people were ever more made up. And I couldn't quite I couldn't quite believe that I then saw the polls had improved hugely, and there was enormous support for Kilroy Silk, which I hope he always wears. You know, she was interviewed and her face fell. Rather a terrifying thing. And apparently we can now vote by email, telephone and post, but it's not going to be delivered because the postal service isn't working. And if we vote, it won't get there till 2009.
It's another example of not very joined up government, though, isn't it? Because on the one hand, they've got this big anti-obesity drive. On the other hand, they're making it possible to just sit on your arse and vote from... not even do that little walk up to the local primary school.
Well, can you imagine the size postmen will be if this goes on? They used to do 5 deliveries a day, but slim as a flute. Postmen weigh 3 tons.
Preparations for all postal votes in the regions of England are in disarray amid reports that some councils have not even printed their ballot papers. Those ballot papers that have arrived have been printed only with the names of the following candidates: Mr. T. Blair, the Prime Minister, Mr. Cheesy Grin, and God. At the end of round one, everybody's doing incredibly well. We start round two with a description of the Loch Fyne restaurant in Portsmouth from the Daily Telegraph.
Housed in a magnificent old building on the water's edge, this is the perfect place for a long lunch. Dinner only.
Thanks to Paul Nichols of Midhurst for sending that in. Linda, whose bonfire of the vanities was the torch of the town?
Torch of the town?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm assuming this is the big fire.
It is.
The great fire of East London. Terrible, huge, great fire in this warehouse in Leighton. Huge amount of the Saatchi collection up in smoke. Actually, most people, if you wrote on an insurance form and there were 100 priceless works of art in that fire, it would be a total lie, wouldn't it? He's the only man in Britain who could write that with any honesty.
Do you like modern art, Linda?
Some of it, well.
It's just that's quite close to where you live, that fire, wasn't it?
It's quite close to where you live. It's quite possible that some local folk might have thought they were doing him a favour, really, thinking, helping him out with a little bit of a, you know, latent lightning.
Surely, isn't it possible to actually claim that the burnt down factory is an installation now?
Exactly.
If it was arsonised and they find the arse who did it, and he then says, I did it because this is a statement of a conceptual art, it's deinstallation or something, I've burned it down, and this is mine and it's worth millions of pounds, and no one can touch it.
But that chap's your hero, Michael Landy, isn't he? The
one Michael Landy,
who destroyed everything he owned.
Yeah,
so you should approve of all
stood
this.
In Selfridges and tore everything up. Yeah, maybe he did it.
Or possibly not. Peaches, my artist. Many of Britain's
turning into Crime Watch.
That's the trouble with East London. Everything's Brit art round my way. You don't know if things are real or an installation. You walk into a pub, you think, is this a real pub or an ironic pub?
Many of Britain's leading contemporary artworks owned by Charles Saatchi have been destroyed in a fire in East London. Works of art destroyed are thought to include Damien Hirst's Careless Man with a Fag and Tracy Emin's Did I Leave the Gas On? Emergency services rushed to the fire in the small hours of Monday morning and spent many hours spraying the burning artworks with petrol. Francis, who apparently moves in insufficiently mysterious ways, his wonders to perform.
Would it be God, by any chance?
Yes, but that's not quite the answer.
Well, I think that is the answer, isn't it? I think you'll find, if you read your Bible, that is the answer. I don't know. Is it the Archbishop of York?
Yes.
He's been complaining that the Church of England is less popular than Harry Potter films and Lord of the Rings and that sort of thing, and he can't imagine why this is. And I thought it's fairly obvious, actually, because you can't eat popcorn in church services. And also, you don't then get to see the service on DVD 6 months later with extra features, special features, exclusive footage of the vicar in the vestry afterwards, down in the communion wine. But anyway, he's awfully upset about this. So I think that's the way to go for the Church of England, if he's worrying about congregations. They should do this. Follow the example of Harry Potter. And merchandising, that's a lot. That lovely little fluffy toys of the nice Archbishop of Canterbury with his beard. Action Man dolls with gay bishop outfits and things like that. They could clean up. But anyway, is it the Archbishop of Canterbury?
Well, both.
They've been wittering on a week. And Canterbury is very hard to follow because he uses words like interiority a lot. So I'm not entirely sure what he meant, but he did say that we needed more interiority. An inner chamber, I think he called it, in which things can echo for some time. Some of us already have these inner chambers, especially after Chicken Joe Frazee, but
I think what the church probably needs is a cult hero. If you look at the fate of Thomas à Becket, if the Archbishop of Canterbury got stabbed by aristocrats live on television, I think the numbers would shoot up.
England's two most senior churchmen have hit out at society's superficiality this week, with York's Dr. David Hope criticising the Church of England for its lack of mystery, while Canterbury's Rowan Williams has attacked the modern portfolio society. Dr. Williams described the ever-shorter attention spans of so many today as worrying, oh, blah, 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 whatever. Andy, listen to this. Andy, which baby came in from the cold this week?
This baby is now 2 years old, but conceived thanks to the foresight of the doctors who suggested to a man 21 years ago, as he was about to undergo chemotherapy, that it might be a good idea to freeze some of his sperm against the eventuality that he wanted to start a family. But I didn't know sperm kept that long.
We have to get rid of our waffles after 6 months. Although they're in the freezer. We've actually tried them after 8 months and they're like bricks. It's very strange.
I'm putting on my scientist white coat now for this bit. I think they actually put it in what is basically antifreeze, don't they, or something?
Wouldn't have to be antifreeze.
Antifreeze.
There were chemicals. Yeah, it was. It's preserved in a chemical.
Professor, and I don't understand.
You've been doing wonderfully. It's now going to turn into a silly, unsavoury, bad joke answer, isn't it?
I didn't go for any of the obvious jokes or any jokes at all.
You didn't say Mum's been to Iceland?
No. Oh.
No, because that would have been cheap.
Exactly.
That's not a plug for Iceland, by the way. That, I don't want to get loads of groceries from them as a thank you.
Doctors at St Mary's Hospital Manchester have claimed a world record revealing that a woman who's given birth to a child conceived using sperm which had been frozen for over 21 years. Over the years, doctors have learned many things about storing sperm in the fridge, the most important of which is never, ever keep it in the mayonnaise jar. Alan, who's licensed to count their kill on the roads?
This is an absolutely extraordinary thing. You can actually get a splatometer. Motorists are being enjoined to sign up to a spot the dead bug on your number plate thing. And I don't know how you do that, because I, like anybody else, I drive. And when you get to the other end, there are sort of nine daddy long legs on it. But you don't know if that's... each one has dropped one leg, or three of them have lost three legs. I don't know how you can work out how many bugs you've killed. But at the end of this great sort of doomsday book in October, we will know how many bugs are killed on the average road by how many motorists. And that will have some knock-on effect with the birds that aren't there, because the bugs they should have eaten to stay there and flourish are actually on your number plate.
Surely.
But I didn't understand any of it. Even as I said that, I didn't understand a word I was saying.
Surely the answer is to tag the daddy long legs.
Drivers are being asked to count the number of squashed bugs on their number plates as part of a survey into declining insect numbers. In Scotland, blood-sucking midges have been blamed for driving away tourists, though Robin Cook says he's not been north of the border for months. And at the end of round two, everybody has 8 points. Before we start the final round, here's an item taken from The Big Issue.
Plane spotters are to employ their expert knowledge to join the fight against terrorism under a radical new ID card scheme. Tony Dixon, editor of Airliner World, said, "The cards are a great idea. Spotters know a great deal about all aspects of aviation, down to the smallest things. If there's someone pulling a surface-to-air missile out of the boot of their car, they'll notice."
Thanks to Alex Brown for that. Linda, listen to this.
If tin whistles are made of tin, what do they make foghorns out of?
Boom, boom!
Does your chewing gum lose its flavour and the bedpost overnight? If your brother says don't chew it, do you swallow it his bite? Can you catch it on your tonsils when you heave it left and right? Does your chewing gum lose its flavour on the bedpost overnight?
Snoop Doggy Dog's gone off rather, hasn't
he? Linda, what's no longer a sticky subject for Singaporeans?
Chewing gum.
Mm-hmm.
2 points, thank you.
Yes, very good.
No, apparently, like just about everything else, chewing gum was illegal in Singapore. It's the most amazingly repressive regime where they've... everything, chewing gum. I don't know about Victory V's, if they're... you can have them. Maybe you can have Victor Lockett's, I think, a borderline. There are, in some areas, there's bylaws against them, but, you know, it's not federal law, basically. But chewing gum was verboten because it makes a lot of mess on the pavement. So you weren't allowed to chew gum. But now you can, but only if you've got a note from your doctor, basically, to say that you need it for medicinal purposes. Now, I don't know what chewing it might be. I don't know, lazy teeth?
But you need a licence, don't you?
A licence, yeah. Actually
need a licence.
And there are detector vans. In case you're trying to chew without a licence. And it's not worth it. So get a licence, not a death sentence, is the slogan. It's quite effective. Seems quite effective, seems to work.
I grew up in Malaya, which is next door to Singapore. The doctor, when I was a child, prescribed two things. He said to my mother that we should chew a lot of gum as children and that we should be sent out to run naked in the rain whenever the monsoons came. And that was his prescription for a happy life. If you chew a lot of gum, he said, no child who's chewed gum and run naked in the rain will come to any harm.
But so you don't chew gum anymore, though, do you?
Certainly not. When you're doing that clever thing of sticking it on the end of your tongue and holding it there and then flipping it back into your mouth. I don't suppose you ever do that, do you? No.
Singapore is to lift its 12-year-old ban on chewing gum, but only for registered users and medicinal purposes. One Singaporean was quoted, this is true, as saying, it's easier for a 16-year-old to visit a lap dancing club than it is to chew gum here. An understandable concern, given that he was speaking as the manager of Spearmint Rhino. Francis, why won't man's best friend be swanning about anymore?
Oh, it's the killer swans.
It is.
They're on a pond in Nottinghamshire. And they're called Edward and Sophie, rather libelously. They took over this pond from some other swans. They muscled in on it, kicked the other swans out, and they sit there, the swans with attitude, especially the male one, who's called a cob, I believe. And whenever any puppies or dogs come along to this pond, this cob goes up to him and says, yeah, you look at my bird. And then he gives them a right uppercut with his mighty wing and then holds these dogs underwater until they drown.
What worries me about this story is that these killer swans are going to catch on round my way in East London as the dangerous pet of choice. Every balcony is going to have this killer swan with a big studded collar saying, Satan. No, he's lovely, he is. He won't hurt you. I won't only break your arm, but no, it's because he loves you.
Pet owners in Nottinghamshire have been told to keep away from a mill pond in Worksop after a killer swan fatally attacked two dogs. The killer swan has inspired a new version of Swan Lake, directed by Quentin Tarantino, called Kill with Bill. Andy, why are doctors being told not to get knotted?
This is Neckties Are a Menace. Shock horror. Now, I've always exempted myself from wearing a tie. I feel that if I was meant to wear a tie, God would have given me a neck. So I only wear ties, you know, looking like Smithy from the Bash Street Kids. I only ever wear a tie if I'm made to, basically. So I'm pleased to announce that the necktie is... they did some studies in hospitals and discovered that neckties are absolutely swarming with deadly germs.
Bow ties are exactly as contaminated. So it must be that male doctors are.
Or...
Stick to female doctors is my answer. I married one 40 years ago. I haven't had a day's illness since. It's obviously male doctors because the bow tie doesn't contaminate.
So, yes. I don't,
well, no, they can't wash
well it. Maybe if it's a spinning one, it might pick up germs on the way round, mightn't it? I don't know. But anyway, so that's it. So if you've got neckties at home, for God's sake, you're better off with a house full of asbestos, I'm telling you.
The BMA has expressed surprise that doctors' ties might contain high levels of dangerous bacteria, as the bacteria should have been killed off by the whiskey doctors spill down their fronts every night. Alan, who's dodgy double dealering just wasn't cricket?
This is... What's his name? Wyn Jones. Alan Wyn Jones' cricket team that Delia Smith was supposed to make the tees for and got enormous credit for doing. And it turns out that she didn't make the sandwiches most of the time. She got them from Marks and Spencer's. She's a liar!
I'm not at all surprised by this story, actually, Alan, because I think Delia Smith's got very untrustworthy hands. Whenever she's making things, they're sort of little, quite chubby, freckly hands. All the little freckles are sort of a bit sinister, I think.
Delia Smith admitted that the lavishly praised teas she'd whipped up for her husband's village cricket team were actually bought from Marks and Spencer's. One team member admitted he should have realised the sandwiches were from M&S when the queue for the tea was divided into cash only and five items or fewer. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings the teams have brought along. Linda.
This is sent in by Adrian Smithies from the New York Times. And it's a quote from Lieutenant Colonel Nathan Sassaman, U.S. Battalion Commander, whose men oversee the village of Abu Hishma in Iraq. With a heavy dose of fear and violence and a lot of money for projects, I think we can convince these people that we're here to help them.
Francis.
Simon, this is from The Guardian's Corrections and Clarifications column. It's about a profile of Daniel Dennett, the American philosopher, the great American philosopher they ran. And it's just a few little corrections. It said, we said he was born in Beirut. In fact, he was born in Boston. His father died in 1947, not 1948. He married in 1962, not 1963. The seminar at which Stephen Jay Gould was rigorously questioned by Dennett's students was Dennett's seminar at Tufts, not Gould's at Harvard. And it goes on like sentence after sentence, column after column. And after this very long correction, the last fact to be corrected is, the marble sculpture that Dennett was working on in 1963 was not a mother and child. It was a man reading a book.
Andy.
This is from Edward Hyde, and it's from BBC News Online. A US woman has been sentenced to 3 months' house arrest after being spotted breastfeeding her child while driving. Catherine Donkers, 29, was nursing her baby daughter on an Ohio highway while driving at 65 miles per hour. In her defence, she said she did not stop because she was talking on the phone to her husband and taking and taking notes on the steering wheel.
Alan.
The rest of my quotes from here to the end of the series are going to be all about George Bush. This one from Wednesday's Daily Telegraph speech that he made with that university thing where he was wearing that hood and gown. We want to make America a literate country and a hopefuller country.
Like that. Now let's look at the final scores. Both teams have a perfect 16 points each. And before we leave you, here's a quote from Sir Terence Conran, seen in The Independent on Sunday.
I go to the Chelsea Flower Show for a bit of amusement. A garden is not just for plants. Look at Dermot Gavin's balls in his garden.
With that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Linda Smith, Francis Ween, Andy Hamilton and Alan Corran. The chairman was Simon Hoggett and the news was read by me, Vaughan Savage. The chairman's script was written by Simon Littlefield, George Poles and Lucy Clark. And the producer was Simon Nichols.